Dr. Jonas, as you know, has written many books on alcoholism, too many to enumerate here. He has been with the World Health Organization as consultant on alcoholism and on many other international bodies and organizations in this particular field. He travels widely all over the world, literally all over the world, studying problems of alcoholism among different cultures, and travels all over the world upon invitation as a consultant to countries and to governments on this problem. I must not stop this attempt to introduce Dr. Jelinek without expressing on behalf of the association our deep appreciation for his willingness to come to us, to take the time that it has required to be here with us during these days and for this evening out of a very busy schedule. I can't express the appreciation that we should all feel for his presence here. It has given our meeting a prestige which it could not otherwise have had. Without any more ado, may I present to you, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. E. Morton Jelinek.
Miller, for your very generous introduction, as well as for decorating me with the Grand Cross of the Order of Knights. Ladies and gentlemen, in the morning, I scan the papers for the most recent news. In the evening, it is my custom to take into my hand the works of some ancient Roman or Greek author and to read some 20 or 30 pages. And then I begin to wonder whether what I read in the evening was the oldest news or what I read in the morning was the newest old. Of course, we are accustomed to say that there is nothing new under the sun. But in spite of that, we commiserate with ourselves and we commiserate with a certain pride that our problems are so new, so recent, that our forebears were never faced with such grave issues. In the case of the problem of alcoholism, we recognize that this problem is as old as the hills. On the other hand, we like to emphasize that it has taken on entirely new forms. And as an example, we point out the matter of alcohol and traffic, or what is called drunken driving. And we believe that this is one of the most modern forms of alcohol problems. Not so long ago, I was reading a Greek author, Athenaeus, who close to 2,000 years ago related the story of the people of the city of Emesa. That city was the center of the worship of the sun god Helios. They offered elaborate sacrifices to the sun god, but they never brought wine into his temple, because they felt that the gods whose onerous duty was to drive the chariot of the sun every day around the earth should not be exposed to the risk of getting intoxicated. So you see that the matter of drunken driving is not so very new. I have brought this up in order to prepare you that I shall hardly be able to present to you anything new tonight. My talk will not only lack novelty, but it won't even offer a well-rounded picture of alcohol programs around the globe. Such an undertaking would involve a lot of detail, which after a good dinner may be quite intolerable. I do not propose to tell you how many tablets of this or that drug are administered to alcoholics in the Republic of San Marino, in Iceland, or in Argentina. And as a matter of fact, I shall not describe treatment methods, although I may make a few superficial allusions to that matter. The object of my talk is to outline the nature of various foreign alcohol programs and to point out similarities and differences. I can only give a few selected examples, even for that. Some of the differences may seem strange to us in North America. Not only strange, but even outrageous. In order to make these differences in policy and method understandable, it will be necessary to talk about differences in the physiological factors of alcoholism and differences in the nature of the alcoholics of various nations. Without some knowledge of the basic differences, some of the alcohol program of some of the foreign nations cannot be understood, and therefore I shall have to extend my talk beyond alcohol program and devote a few words to alcoholism in general. Some of my statements will be regarded as rank heresy. But that really does not matter, especially the psychoanalysts present may be shocked. But they have shocked so many people that it is really their turn to be subjected to a bit of shock therapy. Before I enter on the heretic phase of my talk, I should like to mention a certain matter, lest time should run out and I should be prevented from bringing up this point. This morning, Professor Austin McCormick pointed out that he four times came to his last point. Well, in order that I should not miss the last point, I shall begin with it. And that is that we in North America can claim neither exclusiveness nor even priority in the matter of alcohol programs. We find such programs in sometimes rather elaborate ones in unexpected places. There is, for instance, that small Central American Republic of Guatemala, which has quite a respectable alcoholism. In that small country, they had, they called the patronato contra el alcoholismo, which is subsidized by the government with a budget of $150,000 a year, rather good for such a small country. They had inpatient service, rather too big. They were contemplating an outpatient service. I don't know whether they stuck to it. And they took up a feature which I hadn't found in any other country, at least not in such prominence and so well done. They had read and heard that the lack of recreation, of recreational facilities, was one of the factors in the genesis of alcoholism. Now, of course, it cannot be the object of an alcohol commission to take over the recreational facilities of a nation, but they felt that since other authorities did not see the point, it devolved upon them to develop a pilot project in recreation in order to arouse the interest for such undertakings in those authorities who were on whom it really devolved to develop such activities. Some other Central American republics, Nicaragua, Salvador, Costa Rica, had also some activities around alcoholism, rather rudimentary, not much to speak of, but the beginning is there. Much higher level is reached in South America, prominently in Chile, which I'm going to talk about later, and to some degree, Uruguay, Argentina, and Brazil. In Europe, we find systems in Holland, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Iceland, Switzerland, Ireland, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia, and very recently, in France. It may strike you that I did not mention England. Of course, they have some activities, and some very nice activities in the rehabilitation of alcoholics, but nothing that could be called public care, not to speak of an alcoholism problem. I shall return to England later and shall explain this back. You probably also would like to hear about Russia. I cannot gratify your curiosity on that point. I have not been able to dig up any reliable information on that point. Of course, we know that they had a big alcoholism problem. The indications are that they still had one, although we don't know anything definite. But one thing is sure, that their hope that a communistic society, a communist system, would automatically do away with alcoholism has not been fulfilled. That indication comes from another communist country, from Czechoslovakia. A few months ago, I received a book from Czechoslovak doctor, Dr. Jaroslav Stala, very courageous man, who in the introduction of his book says, of course, you would expect that in a communist country, alcoholism disappears by itself, but unfortunately it is not so. And he begins to develop the described the alcohol problem in his own country. We know very well that the Poles are bothered with alcoholism and that they are trying to do something about it. We know that Yugoslavia has a big alcohol problem. So I suppose that Russia has it too, but I cannot give you any details on what their problem is, nor what they do about it. I've brought this up because usually one of the first questions they ask me after they know that I've traveled around in the world and have looked at this from an international standpoint, what do you know about Russia? I know Sabi nothing. Developments in the Union of South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand are of the most recent origin. I said that we cannot claim priority. Holland, Sweden, Norway, and Switzerland, and in a certain way, Czechoslovakia too, had a head start on us. Holland has clinics, has had clinics for alcoholics since 1912. In Sweden, some form of public care of alcoholics is, I believe, even older. And in Switzerland, at least one canton, the canton of St. Gallen, has a program dating back to the 1890s. I don't say that it is a very wonderful program, but they were among the very first to recognize that a state government or cantonal government has a legitimate interest in this question and also a duty to do something about it. While the priority is not ours, the United States of America, through its activities around alcoholism, has outdistanced many of the countries which started earlier, perhaps with the exception of Holland. And they have outdistanced these countries rather in the matter of rehabilitation of alcohol. In other aspects of alcohol program, mainly in the rounding out and integration of alcoholism programs, we are lagging a bit behind other countries, and some other countries. As I said, our forte is rehabilitation. I think in what we have produced, something that is well superior to what is done in other countries, as I said before, with at the exception of the Netherlands. In some foreign countries, the question of the aspect of research as a part of alcoholism programs has been handled on a very, very high level. I want to mention that Finland, which has a rather broad program, and who only recently has come to a higher level on rehabilitation. It used to be very poor, now the rehabilitation is on a much better level. But there, the one thing in which they have excelled and still excel and probably have beaten us is their sociological research, which is much more cogent, much better designed, much more to the point, much more practical than ours. Nevertheless, we have observed considerable influence on the creation of the alcohol program in Central America, largely through Yale's example, and the examples of some of our older states. Developments in New Zealand, Australia, and South Africa are also strongly influenced by America, and sparked and initiated by American examples, but in this case they are patterned more after the ideology and the program of the National Council on Alcoholism, and also strongly influenced by AA, which came from America into those countries. In South America, in Uruguay, Brazil, Chile, etc., the influence came mainly from the World Health Organization. And the latter has brought about also some changes in European setups. Some European setups which were old but not too vigorous have been brought onto a higher level and a better functioning level through the activities of councils of World Health Organization. Now, having made sure that these points should not be forgotten, I shall return now to the question of differences in etiology of alcoholism and differences in types of alcoholics in various types. I do not wish to imply that the differences in etiology are due entirely to some basic structural differences, but rather to the predominance of certain factors. In all forms of alcoholism, individual psychological factors, social psychological factors, social attitudes, and economic elements play some role. In one country, this or that factor may be more important than another one. And in another country, the rank order may be different. All those factors are present in the alcoholism of every nation. But in one country, this factor is the most important or the most prominent, the predominant one, and in the other country, some other factor predominant. In our country here, I think the individual psychological factor is predominant, and the social, economic factors are secondary. If you talk to a French audience about pre-alcoholic maladjustment, and if you emphasize especially neurotic response patterns, psychopathic response patterns, etc., they shake their heads and go even so far as to deny any role of psychological factors. The French will insist that alcoholism is a purely economic problem. Now, to a certain degree, they are right. But to a considerably large degree, they are wrong. French production of wine, and also of distilled spirits, is very, very large. And to that huge wine production of that country must be added the very considerable wine production of Algeria, which France is obligated to absorb. Now, such an enormous production, of course, requires that it should be sold, too. And it takes quite high pressure methods to sell such enormous quantities. To this comes that the nation as a whole identifies itself with the vessel. Wine is the glorious product of the country, and the identification with the interest, with the economic interest, is very easy through the pride in that wonderful plant with its wonderful product. Now, how far that goes, I may illustrate that one of the first members of the parliament got up and complained that many doctors prescribed for their patients fishy and other mineral waters and said, "This anti-national propaganda must stop." Now, that a politician said that, somehow understandable. But you will find so and so many physicians in France who will maintain that the best antidote against alcoholism is wine. And that in the face of the experience that most of the alcoholism in France comes from wine. Now, as I said, the French will go so far as to deny that there are any psychological factors in drink. I often wondered about that. How are they structured that no psychological element enters into their drink? Well, I lived quite some time in France, traveled around a great deal, visited places and ate in places which are not frequented by tourists. And in some small restaurants, I found in back of the menu a sheet with little cartoons and some slogans under the cartoons. And some of these read, "The wines of France create gaiety. The wines of France give optimism. The wines of France give self-assurance." Well, if these aren't psychological factors, I don't know what. And I say more, that anybody who has to go to wine for a bit of optimism, for a bit of self-assurance, is vulnerable. I like to use this term, vulnerability, instead of pre-alcoholic psychological liabilities, neuroses, etc. Vulnerability is something that even the French will admit and will not be too antagonistic to the use of it. And then vulnerability covers a very, very wide range. From very slight vulnerability, such as, let us say, a little lack of optimism, which means not be an abnormal thing, correctly, right over neurosis to psychosis. The range is enormous. Now, I shall talk then later again a bit about this concept of vulnerability. I needed to put a certain idea over. Come back to the question of this overproduction of wine and some of its derivatives. I want to say that this overproduction, with its various involvements, with its need for high pressure sales, is reflected in social attitude towards drinking. Toward the end of 1953, it must have been in December 1953 and January 1954, the Demographic Institute of France carried out a survey of small scope. They didn't have more than 6 or 8 questions, for which they used a kind of Gallup sample, and asked men and women a few questions, not how much they drink or when they drink, but rather a few opinions about it. For instance, they asked them that in their opinion, how much could a heavily working man drink every day of his life without any harm? The answers averaged out at 2 quarts of wine per day, every day of that man's life. And of course, the average coming out at 2 quarts, that means that quite a few people thought that it could be also 3 quarts and more. I couldn't say now exactly how many percent said that it would be 3 quarts, but it was quite a considerable percentage. Now this means that the French public, the French society, has a very high degree of acceptance of large alcohol intake. It is the norm. Now let us take our own country. Let us take the United States, also Canada, and generally Anglo-Saxon countries, England, the Scandinavian countries, and we will find that in those countries, at least 1/3 of the adult population rejects the use of alcoholic beverages in any form. The remaining 2/3 do not favor large. Of course, they have heavy drinkers among them, but those 2/3 of users in those, adult users in those countries, do not regard as normal a large people. The degree of acceptance of large intake is low. Now, in a society where the degree of acceptance of large intake is low, by and large, those people will be exposed to alcoholism who are most vulnerable. That is, those who either have a neurosis rocket or a new rocket response pattern, or any way has fairly complicated, fairly grave pre-alcoholic deviation. On the other hand, in a country like France, where the degree of acceptance of large food is so high, there it does not require much vulnerability to be exposed to the risk of health. A small degree of vulnerability will be sufficient to lead from the two cloths, which are sufficient for many people to become alcoholics, but it can lead easily over to the three and four cloths quite imperceptibly. That is why we think of alcoholics largely as persons who have some pre-alcoholic trouble, pre-alcoholic personality disorder, or let us say at least fairly strong personality difficulties, we can say, who are highly vulnerable, while in France this is not true. Now, I want to say this. Oh, perhaps I'd better talk first about the drinking pattern in France. The French drinker, by and large, spreads those two or three quarts of wine over the entire day. He begins drinking with breakfast, or before breakfast. And that is a cultural pattern, that is not an alcoholic symptom. He begins with his breakfast, and after that he has a swig or two at the bottle about every hour on the hour, not a large quantity. At the noon meal he has, of course, more. In the afternoon, again, every hour on the hour, something. And at the evening meal, again, more, and perhaps even more than at noon. He spreads those two or three quarts over 16 hours, 16 hours of the day. At no time of the day is he particularly intoxicated, at least not physically. A pharmacologist would say he is intoxicated and he would be right, but it is not over intoxication. It is not physical. On the other hand, there isn't 1 minute in the 24 hours in the day that some alcohol wouldn't be present in his organism. Now, that, of course, brings about a certain adaptation of the organism to this substance. It brings about what we may call tissue adaptation. And actually it happens that such a French drinker, who has rarely been seen drunk, oh, surely on the 14th of July he will have been drunk, that day, and perhaps on some other occasions, but it is not a common occurrence with him to be drunk. He has been rarely seen drunk. Nobody regards him as an alcoholic. And one day he stands there with delirium tremens. This is a very common experience in France, in Switzerland, and some other countries. also this man may sense to the point. Is very different from our alcoholic. He is able to control his alcohol use. Our alcoholics cannot stick to one glass. They may say, I will have one glass, two glasses, and they end up with 20. They lose control. Now this French inveterate drinker does not lose control in the sense that he cannot regulate his thinking. The three-quart man can say, today I'll have only half a pint, or only a pint. And he's able to stick, but he is not able to drink zero. He is able to drink a little on that day, but he isn't able to drink nothing. If he drinks nothing, he begins to sick. And he has to go back to the doctor. He doesn't need much. He won't get drunk. Very different. But the fact that he gets withdrawal symptoms if he does not drink one day shows that in spite of the fact that he has not shown any drunken behavior, he has reached a status of tissue adaptation. Now, my psychoanalytic friends, and they are friends, and friends whom I admire, even if I tackled some of this before, need not think that this statement of mine means that these people drink because they have tissue adaptation. The fact that they drank such a lot before they reached tissue adaptation has, of course, its individual psychological involvement and very serious social psychological involvement. It is only the fact of not being able to stop which is brought about through a physical process, which frankly cannot be called anything else but addiction. Addiction, well, frankly, in the same sense as drug addiction. The process is very similar. The effect of alcohol, of course, is very different from that of the so-called narcotic drug. Also, the quantitative differences are enormous. While extremely small quantities of morphine given over a period of 2 or 3 weeks can make a man addicted, it would take very large quantities of alcohol over a very long time to bring about the same adaptation. But the adaptation process is very, very similar, whether we like it or not. I would say that the French have not only this inveterate drinker type whom I described, they have also the type of the alcoholic who is familiar to us here in the United States. But let us call it just for convenience sake, the American type of alcoholic is there a minority group in the alcoholic population? I am very sure, and I'm not just supposing because I've seen them in America, we have in America also the French inveterate drinker type. But he constitutes a minority in our alcohol. It is quite natural that we should gain our picture our ideas about the alcoholic and alcoholism from this majority group. It is quite natural that that strikes our eyes. This is the thing that comes to our mind, and we generalize from this majority to all. Although the minority may be quite excited. Again, in France, it's the same thing. They take their picture and their ideas of alcoholism from the majority of their alcoholic population and forget that there is a sizable minority to whom these ideas just do not apply. And here, just as in the question of physiological factors, where I said that we have to talk about predominance and not about basic structural differences. Also in the question of alcoholics, we have to talk about predominant types and minority types. And it would be, of course, very good if we would recognize those minorities and would not try to apply to them what only pertains to the majority. Predominant nature of alcoholics, of French alcoholics, has various consequences. Various consequences in handling them, various consequences in attitudes towards them. One of those consequences is the great difficulty of establishing Alcoholics Anonymous in French, or generally in Latin countries. Because most Latin countries are viticultural and have similar patterns, although I would say that the Italian pattern is very different from the French. Now, this inveterate drinker type that I described, French inveterate drinker, who is very rarely drunk, yet who shows withdrawal symptoms when he's drunk, does not go through those experiences through which our alcoholics have. They do not have those interpsychic experiences. They do not get into such trouble with themselves. They do not get into such trouble with society, with their family, except very late. Of course, there comes a time after 20 years of such this kind of drinking when the man, although he does not show over drunkenness, is too ill to go to work. He begins to lose time, and he begins to lose, through that, of course, firm power. And then he gets into trouble with his wife. Then some troubles arise, and he might come even so far as to want to do something about it. But generally, he has not gone through those harassing experiences which our alcoholics go through. And therefore, the ideology of Alcoholics Anonymous does not appeal. It means very little to him. And this has a certain consequence also for us here. So often in Alcoholics Anonymous they say that so and so came here and dropped out after two or three sessions because he was not right for us. I wonder whether he ever will be right in the sense of AA. Because perhaps he represents exactly this French inveterate drinker type to whom the alcohol Alcoholics Anonymous ideology does not need help. And yet it is a man who needs help and who finds help. And of course, second, it has its consequences in various preventive measures and in the hands of the alcoholic. I will take as an example Switzerland, where the French type of alcoholic is also predominant. They have other types too, but in France, still the majority type is the French inveterate Christian. Now, Switzerland has very great activity with alcohol problems, and especially in the field of rehabilitation. And they do some things which to us would sound outrageous and stupid, and which are not so stupid if one knows that they do it. For instance, if it comes to the notice of the authorities that so and so seems to be an alcoholic, they try to make a diagnosis, is alcoholic or in danger of being an alcoholic. They talk about the alcohol endangered person. And they will warn him and put him for 3 months on probation and say, "Brother, for 3 months you are not going to put your foot into a bar. You are not going to go into a liquor store. You are not going to buy liquor and you are not going to drink. And if you do, if you violate this probation, then we shall take much more serious steps, and it might go even so far as to place you on the jury list, to appoint a guardian, which is an enormous gross interference into the man's liberty." And they feel that this is a very useful procedure, that very many of these people are scared away. Now, are scared away from continuing on an alcoholic career. Of course, thus, it sounds enormously stupid, because we have not seen an alcoholic yet who could be scared out of it. That's true here. But there's where there are many alcoholics in whom the three alcoholic vulnerability was of a rather low degree, where alcohol has not become so enormously important, not become the center of the life of that man, but is rather a thing that comes out of the custom of his society. He can be scared away, especially with such a prospect as being placed on the jury. Of course, the method fails 100% if it is applied in Switzerland to an alcoholic of our type, of the Americans. Of course, that they don't get anywhere. Now, I want to say that while the Swiss do have this principle, and in practically every canton, it is possible to place the man on the guardianship, and the guardian can demand compulsory treatment for him. The Swiss are very careful in not doing this power.
They do it only in absolutely extreme cases when everything else fails. And also this enabling law that makes it possible to place the man under juice is so hedged around with safeguards that it is pretty difficult to take the court to this very extreme level. Now, I would say that the trouble with the Swedish system of rehabilitation is that the Swedes have misjudged their alcohol. Somehow, the so-called temperance board who handle the public care of alcoholics in Sweden once that it was benevolent authoritarianism, but a Danish friend of mine doubted that it was benevolent. Now, it's interesting that Swedish psychiatry is on a very high level. There are Swedish psychiatrists who know an awful lot about very high level. There are Swedish psychiatrists who know an awful lot about that, who understand the matter first, and who know how to treat them. And yet these excellent psychiatrists, with their quite outstanding knowledge, have not been able to influence those authorities in whose hands the rehabilitation of alcoholism. They have not been able to make a dent. Only very reason that the medical profession and particularly psychiatrists have gained some influence on the rehabilitation of alcoholism. Interestingly enough, this change has come about since the application of antabuse. Because, and I would say that antabuse did a lot of good to the medical profession and to the public at large, much more good than it did the alcoholics. It changed the minds of many of the doctors who thought that this was not a medical problem. But when they found that there is a medicine with which one can stop or temporarily stop or influence the thing, then the idea did sink in that, well, if one can do something with a medicine, then it is a medical problem. And of course, what is more important, the general public got that idea, and with that, a change has begun taking place in Sweden. And the medical profession now is beginning to have influence on the rehabilitation of alcoholics. Generally, I find that in Europe, that with the exception of Holland, the rate of success in the treatment of alcoholics is much lower than we can claim here. That is largely due to that attitude of authoritarianism, of here sitting the doctor or the social worker, more in the capacity of an official. And there, more or less, is the label. So, there does not develop that warmth which develops here between the therapist and the alcoholic, and which is really a chunk for much of our success here. I said that uh,
there is quite a bit of difference that we lag, perhaps, in the matter of integration of alcoholism programs, that some of the foreign countries have done best in well-rounded programs and in highly integrated programs. And I will give only one example. For this, I shall refer to Chile in South America. The whole of that program is not in effect yet, but much of it has been already in effect for some time, and the rest is being developed now. Chile has nationalized medicine. The Chilean National Health Act is 2 or 3 years older than the English National Health. And the Chilean National Health Service has taken up the question, the problem of alcoholism, because they were plagued by it. Whatever they did in the field of tuberculosis, nutrition, etc., has been torn down by the enormous, there is no other way, other word for it, but boost that goes on in Chile. It tears down everything. At last, the public health service got so desperate when they saw that they were being frustrated in all their efforts through the interference of excessive drinking, that they decided to do something about alcoholism itself. And they did this on they worked out an entirely, fully rounded, well-integrated system. First, they put up one or two outpatient clinics in the capital in Santiago as a kind of private clinic. Now, we know that Chile is a long, sausage-shaped country, thousands of miles, and, of course, placed the outpatient clinics in the capital will not suffice to serve the country. They knew very well they had to put up clinics in each health center. The country is divided into some 25 or 26 health centers. But of course they knew that one cannot just open a clinic and say that this will do the job. They knew very well that they have to have trained personnel. So they worked out now a 5 or 6 year training program. Every year they take 5 physicians and 5 social workers who go through a 3-month course in the Santiago clinic and then go back to their health. Also, since they know very well that they have to do alcohol education too, and that they cannot specialize too much in these training courses for the staff of rehabilitation clinics, they also have a highly professional course on alcohol education given by professional health educators that is integrated right into this teaching process. By the way, I want to say that Chile is perhaps the only country where it is obligatory for medical students to take a 6-week course on alcoholism. This has been in force for the last 2 years. But this idea of a training program in order to establish more clinics is a splendid and basic requirement. as I said, the question of alcohol education is right integrated into that training program and starts from a very good place. They do not single out alcohol education, something that is taken arbitrarily out of a vacuum and put here on the table, but they connect it with education on nutrition. That is, they start with education on nutrition and then show that it's not only what you eat, but also what you drink. They bring in the calories, the calories emanating from alcoholic beverages, and so the matter comes in quite naturally. And once they have gotten, you know, the role of alcoholic beverages in the nutritional setup, it is quite easy to go from there generally into the pharmacology of alcohol without arousing antagonism. Also, they have formed a group on research. They have a National Alcoholism Research Institute, which is substituted as a university department, the Laboratory of Nutrition, the Laboratory of Pharmacology, the Laboratory of Genetics, and the Department of Psychiatry. And these researchmen from this department, from this institute, have seminars together with the National Health so that the activities of the research and the activities of the practical men in the field of clinical activities are in constant contact, and one gives sense to the other. Now it's getting pretty late, and I will have to finish this talk. I shall have to skip a few things which I wanted to say. In those various countries in which alcohol programs exist, there are different agencies. Yesterday the question came up in a little meeting that we had here of which government department is most suitable for handling the administering alcohol programs. Is it the public health? Is it welfare? Is it Department of Interior? What do I know? Whatever it is, or a separate agency, an integrative body, and so on. And my answer to that was that you have to examine that country by country. You can't ask which department is most suitable, but in this country which department, in that country which department, it has a great deal to do with the type of alcohol, with social conditions, with social attitudes, and so forth. Now, let's take, for instance, in Yugoslavia, the matter has been handed over to the Red Cross. Of course, the Red Cross in Yugoslavia is a government agency. And it has focus in every little rich country. And of course, it is staffed by very good physicians. When they got this task thrown into their lap, they didn't know very well what to do. They didn't know much about alcoholism. They blundered around, and I want to say that they are not only in charge of clinical work, of rehabilitation, but also education on alcoholism. First, they were just blundering, and their efforts weren't worth much, but slowly they began to learn. And now there are in Yugoslavia quite a number of facilities for the rehabilitation of alcoholics. Some of them are very mediocre, and some of them are on a quite respectable level. They are getting better and better. Still, a lot of mistakes are made, as in present Zagreb in one of the clinics, and saw how alcoholics were practically fried by giving them too much antidote and too high test dosages. They were as red as big unnecessary torture. In Czechoslovakia, it is the public health department. In Switzerland, they, according to the canton, each canton has its own laws, each canton has its own systems, and the handling of the alcohol program is in all kinds of hands, ranging from the Department of Interior over the Poorhouse Administration Agency right to the Public Health Agency. And in some of those cantons, this or that agency handles it very well, and in another canton, the same agency handles it very badly. And it is awfully hard to know, to make general decisions. One great difference between the alcohol programs in Europe and here is that they have a much greater emphasis on prevention. They are, of course, all interested in rehabilitation. They all have their rehabilitation activities. But the principle is to do something in order to cut down the necessity for rehabilitation. And for this, of course, they use so-called preventive education. Now, in the brief of our public and private agencies concerned with alcoholism, the word prevention is prominent. The activity of prevention is not prominent. We limit our alcohol education to popularizing the idea that the alcoholic is a sick person, that can be rehabilitated, can be helped, and that it is worthwhile helping him and a public duty to help. This is very good, and unfortunately this side is neglected in Europe. We are more concerned with education on the effects of that. And we are not doing much in that field. We think that the best thing is to educate about alcoholism and to leave the other questions of drinking alone. Not to say anything about them, not to mix in order not to get the taint of belonging to this or that side. And usually they bend over backwards in order not to be regarded as dry. They don't mind so much if they're regarded as wet. And that is quite a little fault of our alcohol education. Now, I've carried out a survey of drinking customs in Europe, in 11 countries, and also in one country of South America.
And I've noticed that differences in customs and differences in attitudes account to a very high degree for differences in alcoholism rates. For instance, the great difference in the rate of alcoholism between France and Italy can be accounted nearly entirely by two factors: the difference in the drinking pattern and the difference in social attitudes towards drinking and towards drunkenness. These things we have to know. We have to know those drinking customs. We are only getting at them here. We have to know those drinking customs and attitudes because those two have to form a subject of preventive education. It is not enough to popularize the idea of the rehabilitation of the alcoholic, nor of the various effects of alcohol on the body, the mind, so on, but we have to educate out certain customs and attitudes which foster alcohol. Now, that also belongs into this field, into the entire field, control legislation, control of consumption. That is, control of sales and through that of consumption. Of course, we have our license laws and we have various stipulations about license premises. In this state, you have to stand at the bar when you drink, and in another one, you have to sit down when you drink. And in the one place, you have to eat when you drink, and in the other one, you're not allowed to eat when you drink, and so forth. And some of these laws sound very funny and very silly, and they don't only sound silly, they are silly. And Europe also has its silly and funny laws, but it has also some quite potent laws. But here, as well as in Europe, people are very skeptical about the efficacy of control laws. They always say, yes, a law, this has been tried out, and that has been tried out, and nothing had an effect. Actually, they have not carried out investigations of whether certain control laws were effective or not. They only come down to this, well, you can't tell because there are this factor, that factor, social factors, and this and that. You cannot isolate the role played by the control law. But we have now a very good opportunity to see actually that some laws do have restraining influences. As you know, in Sweden, there was a personal license. Not only premises were licensed to sell, or rather they had monopoly, the sales monopoly, production monopoly, with certain licenses for restaurants and so on, but the consumer, the individual consumer was licensed. He had a purchase book without which he could not buy, and through that a certain control could be exercised over his buying. Now, after some years, the Swedes said this was entirely ineffective, it wasn't worth the less. Let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of these personal license books. And this was supported also by the temperance movement in Sweden. The temperance people in Sweden were quite in agreement. Let's abolish this stuff. They did abolish it. It was the end of 55, November 55. I think it became effective on 1st January 56. And then it turned out that it was a refrain. Now what they thought was that if they abolish these books, And not everybody for prestige purposes has one now and is therefore less to try. And if at the same time they are putting up the price of liquor pretty high and that of so-called strong beer very low, then the consumption will be channeled from hard liquor to strong beer. That was true for 2 months. And after 2 months, the consumption of strong beer dropped back to its original level, and by now, the consumption, in 2 years, the consumption of distilled spirits has gone up 35%. It was last year when I was out in Chile that I received a letter from a Swedish doctor who is on the staff of an alcoholic rehabilitation clinic. He wrote to me that he had heard that I had an abbreviated interview form, and would I send that to him because it's the abolition of this personal license book. Drunkenness had increased so terribly that the influx into the rehabilitation centers was so that they couldn't handle the interviews anymore. Unfortunately, I did not possess that abbreviated form, but it shows what has been going on there and that one cannot just cold shoulder the effect of such I do not try to advocate here the personal life. I don't think it would work here, perhaps. Now, in summary, I've come down to this, the end of the balance sheet. Here, as well as in other parts of the world, there is still a great deal of hit and miss methods grounded in insufficient knowledge, sweeping generalizations, and misunderstandings. I feel, however, very confident indeed that the great improvements can be achieved if here in America, as well as in other countries, we begin to rethink our problems in the light of international experience. With our experience about alcoholism, rehabilitation of alcoholics, and of alcohol programs in general. That's all.